Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people on Capitol Hill whose, intelligence, as well as whose personal engagement in this war for the free world has been more impressive than our first guest. He is Congressman Scott Perry. He represents with great distinction the people of the 4th Congressional District of Pennsylvania, has done so since 2013. He serves on the Committee on Foreign Affairs, as well as the Committee on Homeland Security, as well as the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. He is the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee's Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations, and has been active in that regard, as many others, in bringing to bear his experience, among other things, as an Army Brigadier General in now reserves to the understanding of the threats we're facing and how they best might be countered. Congressman Perry, it's so good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Frank. Appreciate it, as always.
I wanted to talk to you about something that you and several of your colleagues did last week, which I thought was just extraordinary. It was not a formal hearing, but it was a meeting that had many of the qualities that we would want in formal oversight investigations and hearings, specifically on this so-called House IT scandal. One of my colleagues is calling it the House Spy T scandal, and I wondered what you make of what you found last week.
Well, sure, Frank, and thanks for asking. And of course, I think one of the big issues for people to realize and know is that it wasn't a formal hearing, and that really is the point. There should be formal hearings on this issue. This is the issue regarding the Pakistani family and affiliates that the Democrat, well, we don't know if the National Committee, that's the political side, but certainly the Democrat conference or caucus employed them. How they do this is these are shared employees, because each member of Congress doesn't need a full-time IT person. So they share an employee, up to 40 or maybe even more than 40 Democrats only employed this Awan crew and their affiliates to do their IT work. Among other things, you'll find that it's they're saying it's bank fraud and so on and so forth. But the big issue is a server that was placed kind of outside of the caucus, and all the information from 40 members of the Democrat caucus, all that information moved offsite and then able to be accessed even after Mr. Awan was fired and all his affiliates fired, the moving of hundreds of thousands of dollars to Pakistan, the moving of individuals associated to Pakistan, and of course, the potential breach of any security regarding all that information, including constituent information. But the problem is, Frank, is that the House leadership will not hold hearings, will not get into this, and we don't know how deep this rat hole goes. So we held somewhat of an impromptu hearing to try and get this information out, to pique the interest of the American people, and to put some pressure, so to speak, on our leadership. This is an important issue that I think that the American people need to know about, and members of Congress need to know about. And let me just dare say this as well, Frank. The Democrat National Committee says that Russia hacked their servers and got the information that ended up on WikiLeaks regarding the most recent election between Secretary Clinton and President Trump. We don't know any of that to be true. And of course, we do know that the FBI never looked at the Democrat National Committee's computers in that investigation, just took the DNC's word for it that the Russians did it. What also came out of that impromptu hearing, which is all public knowledge, by the way, was that Imran Awan, the guy that was running this thing, had the password for Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and that the DNC had contacted him to get her password. And we also know, based on retired intelligence operatives, that the information from the WikiLeaks release was not transferred over the air. It was moved much too quickly. That means a physical transfer, either onto a CD or a DVD or some kind of media.
meaning some kind of in-house operation.
Yeah, this is an inside job at the DNC, so to speak. And is it possible that this Awan was connected to that? And I don't want to be engaging in rumor and hyperbole here, but these are reasonable questions based on the information we already know. And how will we ever know if that's true if we have no hearings, if we have no interest in getting to the facts?
Well, it's absolutely vital. And Congressman Scott Perry, what you've really laid out here, and I think your colleague, Congressman Jim Jordan, put a rather fine point on it, as I understand, in the course of this this meeting. It looks as though there's kind of a Pakistani espionage ring of some kind operating in the Congress, or has been, and this would seem to me to be something that is crying out for official scrutiny and investigations and public hearings. You've mentioned that the leadership doesn't seem to want to do that. Congressman, can you shed light on why?
Listen, there's a million reasons, I suppose, why they don't want to do it. They don't think there's anything there. Maybe they don't want to pick on a colleague on the other side. I really don't know. And quite honestly, Frank, I don't care. I think we have a duty of oversight. Let's just look at this. I mean, we had one member simply write off $120,000 in lost computer equipment. That's taxpayer money, Frank. I mean, $120,000 is, in Washington speak, I guess, is nothing. But to real taxpayers, that's real money. I guarantee you, my constituents would not stand for me writing off $120,000 in just lost computer equipment. I think that this story goes much deeper than we know, and we're never going to know unless we start looking into it.
Amen. And speaking of money, as I understand it, these five or six of these characters in this ring earned something on the order of $7 million in taxpayer salaries.
Over the course of the contract, upwards of $7 million. They literally hired 20 early 20s year old employees with zero IT experience who never showed up, as we understand it, for the job at salaries that would make most Americans blush. Look, we can be looking into the IRS commissioner. We can be looking into the past administration security clearances and unmasking Samantha Power. There's no end of the amount of hearings that should be going on in Washington, D.C. right now.
The kind of thing that I think you were elected to do. Exactly right. Hey, Congressman, let me take advantage of the fact that you have served actually in combat in the Middle East to ask you a question about a development that occurred overnight. The Iranian-run government of Iraq, its own military personnel, as well as the so-called Shiite militias, which are essentially, as best I can tell, arms of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, have gone into the Kurdish areas of northern Iraq with force and are now engaged in the violent seizure of oil fields and military bases. And apparently the city of Kirkuk is going to come under their attack as well. Where do you come down, sir, on where our interests lie in this regard, and what should the Trump administration be doing in response?
Well, unfortunately, I think we are really going to have to decide where we stand with Turkey, or Turkey's going to have to decide where they stand with the United States and NATO and the EU. And I think we are playing, we are involved in a delicate dance in that regard, because we have air bases and other installations in Turkey that support our operations in the Middle East. And we have generally been a friendly nation, but things have changed dramatically. And of course, the Turks, as well as the Iraqis, the Iranians, the Syrians, nobody wants the Kurds to have their own free state. And of course, the Kurds just had a recent election, and they've been a reliable ally for the United States, even though we've abandoned them time and time and time again. I think we either watch Iran have more and more influence and maybe even annex portions of Iraq. I mean, that's literally what this looks like their intentions are, to a certain extent, certainly to be the hegemon, the regional hegemon, and completely control Iraq. Or we decide that it's time that we work with the people that have been willing to work with us time and time and time again, and not do what we saw happen in Vietnam, where we just ended up in total defeat and disgrace, getting nothing out of losing 50,000 lives and untold treasure and credibility around the world. So I think that's really what's happening here. It's certainly Iran, flexing their muscles and their might in their attempt to be the regional hegemon. and other countries in the neighborhood allowing it to happen so that they don't have to deal with the Kurds, although they don't want the Kurds any more than the Iranians do. They're just allowing Iran to do their dirty work, and the United States has to decide where we stand.
Congressman, we'll talk more about that with Louise Fleischman shortly, but thank you very much for your insights into it, as well as your leadership on this House spy tea scandal. I hope you'll stay on it and come back to us again with further reports in the near future. Thank you for all of your service to our country in uniform, as well as in the Congress. Congressman Scott Perry, God bless you. Next up, we'll talk with Gordon Chang about Iran and North Korea, and what it might mean for you that they are partners in crime. Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back for our weekly visit with Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent experts on, and certainly most prolific contributors to, our understanding of what's developing in the Asian front of what I think of as the war for the free world. He is a contributor to the Daily Beast and the author of two extraordinarily important and very prescient books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon Chang, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Gordon, you have written recently at Forbes about a very troubling axis. I guess George W. Bush coined the phrase axis of evil, but I'd like to get your thoughts on its current manifestations, namely the relationship between Iran, of which we have been speaking a moment ago with Congressman Scott Perry, and North Korea. What exactly, as you read it, is the strategic partnership and the implications of it?
Well, Iran and North Korea have been in a partnership on both nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. This has gone on for about two decades, maybe a little bit more. And currently, Iran pays North Korea, it's estimated, somewhere between $2 and $3 billion a year for their various forms of cooperation. This cooperation probably has continued past the effective date of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, what we know as the Iran nuclear deal. There are indications that Iranian technicians were on site for North Korea's two detonations of atomic devices last year. That's after the October 2015 effective date of the JCPOA. And this is something that we need to look at because various administrations have been incurious about this relationship between Tehran and Pyongyang. Certainly the Obama administration was. The Trump administration, I think, is more interested. And indeed, this would be one reason not to continue certification of the Iran deal, because I don't think we can say at this particular time that Iran has ended its cooperation with the North Koreans over nuclear weapons research.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Gordon, let me switch gears with you. Of course, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, has been prominently involved in, well, it appears, some rather difficult conversations with the President of the United States about how to deal with these two nations. President Trump having been much more hardline, having said to Mr. Tillerson he thinks it's a waste of time to talk to the North Koreans, having said that this JCPOA, as it's called, is not actually in the interests of the United States. Would you talk a little bit about that relationship, Gordon, and the extent to which this is somewhat extraordinary to have such public rifts between the president and well, at least one, if not several, of his senior subordinates?
Rex Tillerson on North Korea has emphasized diplomacy, while the president has said that that's not the way to go. This is an extraordinary rift, as you say, and it really is up to the president to enforce message discipline, something that's been lacking in this administration. The one thing that I'll say about Tillerson's approach to North Korea is that he's been over-optimistic. And this was really most, I think, graphically highlighted in late August, when he said that the North Koreans had not engaged in a provocation since August 5, which was the date of UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea. And he thought that this period showed that the North Koreans were on a pathway to dialogue. Now, at the time, it sounded naive, and indeed it's proved to be that way, because on September 3, the North Koreans detonated what is almost certainly a thermonuclear device. And so the North Koreans humiliated not only Secretary Tillerson, but also the United States, because he does speak for the U.S. So I think that President Trump needs to sort this out. He is the president, and he's got to make sure that his administration speaks with one voice, because North Korea is such a danger, not only to the United States, but to the entire international community.
Now, Gordon, you studied these things rather closely. Rex Tillerson, at one point, in the midst of one of the more public disagreements with the president, talked about, as I recall, three different back channels for communicating with the North Korean regime. Did that surprise you? And what, in your experience, has been the results of such conversations with the North Koreans, for that matter, front channel, but most especially back channel?
The United States has always had back channel discussions with the North Koreans, especially through the North's UN ambassador. I was a bit surprised that they said that there were more than one, and clearly Secretary Tillerson wanted to pursue them. You know, at this point, the channels are okay in the sense that, you know, it doesn't hurt to talk to the North Koreans, but at least on a low-level basis. But I think Secretary Tillerson was much, much too enthusiastic about this as really being a way forward. You know, at this point, I do believe that this crisis should end in diplomacy, but only when the North Koreans realize that they have to disarm, that they have no choice but to surrender their weapons. Right now is way too premature to have any sort of structured formal negotiations or discussions with the North Koreans, because they're going to do what they did during the Bush administration's six-party talks. They're going to use negotiations to buy time, to improve their arsenal of weapons. And so we should not make that mistake again.
Gordon, in our previous conversations, and again, our guest is Gordon Chang, who is these days a columnist for The Daily Beast and the author of The Coming Collapse of China. You've talked to me about the extent to which China is really calling the shots with respect to the North Koreans and how important it is to hold them accountable for doing so and to really disincentivize them from engaging in such behavior. You wrote recently at Forbes about the smart money being on Steve Bannon, who has taken a very hardline view of the Chinese, in very much, I think, that vein especially. What is your reason for thinking that he's got it right and that, in fact, that's where the smart money should be?
Yeah, Steve Bannon, who was once the president's chief strategist, has identified China as America's principal adversary and is the principal danger to the United States. And I think that that's clear across the board, whether we're talking about trade, cyber attacks, or North Korea. And what Bannon wants to do is to make this issue, put this issue front and center during the 2018 elections and, of course, 2020. And that's really important for us because right now China is destabilizing the international system. It wants the U.S. out of Asia. It wants to destabilize the United States and its democracy and attacking our democracy just like the Russians are. We've got to recognize the danger. Bannon sees it, wants to make it an issue. And in this regard, he's absolutely right.
Well, one other dimension of this is the one we've periodically addressed and I've spoken about at length, including last week with Kevin Freeman, and that is the Chinese seeming desire to accelerate the movement towards having the yuan replace the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. We're seeing some of that playing out at the moment in Venezuela, a relatively small-scale player, to be sure. And we'll be talking about that with Louise Fleischman and Russ Dallin in the segments ahead. But Gordon Chang, it does seem to me as though what you've described here, and I think the way Steve Bannon puts it is that China is at war with us, is that we have, in fact, an adversary in China who is very, very happy to have the North Koreans continuing to distract us at best and threaten us at worst, and has not yet made the calculation that they need to reverse that course. I know you'll be following it closely, as will we, with your work. Gordon Chang, it's so good to talk with you. I look forward to doing so again next week. Thank you for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with Russ Dallin about developments in Venezuela with the elections over the weekend and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined, I'm pleased to say, once again by Russ Dallin, the president and editor-in-chief of the Latin American Herald Tribune. He is also the head of an international investment bank. Caracas Capital Markets has spent many years in Venezuela, follows very closely developments there, including, most recently, a remarkable outcome in elections that were held in the various states in Venezuela over the weekend with some rather distressing results. It's good to have him back. Russ, thanks so much for joining us.
Secretary Gaffney, always an enlightening pleasure, sir.
Let's talk a little bit about what happened in the course of these elections on Sunday. Is it as you anticipated they would come out?
Sadly, I have been following the fraud in the Venezuelan elections for many years now, and this exceeded my expectations for their fraud. This was so blatantly fraudulent as to differ tremendously from both the polling before the election as well as the exit polling after the election. There was just, going into this election, the opposition had about between 60 and 80% support, a majority of the country. The government had 20 to not even 30, but in the 20% support. Yet they're claiming that they won 17 of the 23 states in the country, which diverges enormously from what the opposition did when they did have last free and fair elections in 2015, when the opposition stomped on the government. And the situation in the country has deteriorated greatly since those elections in December of 2015, and yet the government's numbers went up, belies belief.
Yeah. So is there evidence at this point as to how this theft of the election took place in 17 of those states, or is it just business as usual for the government, cooking the books and putting out whatever numbers they choose?
It almost looks like it's too early to tell, and we're starting the analysis, and indeed I testified before Congress on the last elections, before the Senate, on how they committed the fraud. We're still going through the numbers. It's still too early. We just got them late, and we don't even have complete numbers yet. So we'll look as they cook them and then go through and see how they got these impossible numbers. But even before that, the fraudulent was set up. They imported a lot of tactics from the Nicaraguans, who have learned how to play this game, including changing voting polling places at the last minute. So that, for example, my voting place was changed on Thursday. So 2 days before my wife's polling place was changed. It's been the same for 35 years, and they changed it at the last minute as well. One of my staff was actually watching in a morning meeting. We were just talking about it in the morning meeting on Friday, and they changed it from the time he hit refresh on his screen, and they had changed his voting center 2 days before. So they call it, in Nicaragua, they call it loco raton, or raton loca, crazy mouse. Basically, they make you run through a maze to try and exercise your democratic right to vote.
And in the process, more often than not, probably precluding people from voting who would cast ballots against the government's favored candidates. Let me ask you, this is so palpable a case of fraud that apparently, in Europe, as we're speaking, as a matter of fact, Russ Dallin, there is an effort underway to impose new sanctions on the government of Venezuela. What do we know about what the governments in Europe are likely to do? And what is your recommendation at the moment as to what we should be doing as well?
So it looks like that the Europeans are going to go with individual sanctions on members of the Venezuelan regime who violate human rights, which is kind of the same steps that Canada just took in the last 2 weeks, as well as what the U.S. has been doing all along in terms of targeting the most egregious violators of human rights, including the electoral board, the four women that basically made all these decisions and allow this incredible cheating to go on. And I should point out, by the way, that the company that had done the vote tallies for Venezuela, that provided the machines, designed the programs, wrote the software, and ran the machines and maintained them and basically controlled all of the software, came out after the July elections and said basically there was a fraud of over 1 million votes in the government's tally from their own tallies. And, of course, the government proceeded to fire that company and brought in another small, unheard-of company named after Che Guevara. This fraud was written a long time ago.
So for our purposes here in the United States, Russ Dahlin, we're watching this train wreck continue to play out, obviously. The privation of the people of Venezuela is acute and getting worse. The government nonetheless clings to power, even as the economy continues to nosedive into the ground. The oil basket, as you reported last week, has slipped again. The devaluation of the currency is going forward. Given all of that, what would you recommend the United States government, the Trump administration, do to try to really change the course here, if anything?
It's getting more and more difficult. We've exhausted the easier sanctions where we just sanctioned individual people. Now we're going to have to move to another level where there's going to be greater pain involved. It could mean stopping exports of our oil, refined oil products back to Venezuela, which they very much depend on to run their machinery, including the gasoline for their tanks, to perhaps embargoing all Venezuelan oil so that they can't come here, or even the halfway mark saying, we'll accept the oil, but we're going to pay you in food. You're going to have to feed your people, just like we did with Iraq in the oil for food program that the United Nations ran. But we've exhausted basically the soft sanctions, and if we want to avoid another Cuba with the largest oil reserves in the world growing on our shores, we're going to have to start acting and acting more aggressively.
And on that point about food as a form of payment, I know that the Venezuelans are actually denominating their oil sales in Chinese yuan at the moment. Were we to institute a food payment, is there reason to believe the food would actually get to the people of Venezuela who so desperately need it, Russ Dahlin, or would this simply be plowed into the take of the regime and its various narco and other kleptocratic operations?
Sadly, you've hit the nail on the head again, Frank. The military actually controls food distribution in the country. There's actually a general in charge of each food product. There's a general in charge of rice. There's a general in charge of beans. There's a general in charge of beef. There's a general in charge of chicken, and I kid you not. But there is so much corruption in each of those things. They're making money by the differential between what they bill and what is actually paid. But then they're also reselling it, and they're also delivering it to regime supporters. So we would have to find a way to bypass regime control so that the corruption would be taken out, as well as using it for their own nefarious purposes to starve people who don't support them.
Well, this is a hard bit of business, needless to say, when they control all of the instruments of power. But very quickly, you've called the devaluation the Voldemort rate. tell us what you're referring to there, and how significant has the devaluation of the currency been?
Let's put it this way. If you'd had a dollar in Venezuelan currency on January 1st, you'd have basically 10 cents left. You'd have a dime of that dollar left if you'd held it in the bank. We call it the Voldemort devaluation because it's illegal to say what the actual street rate, the black market rate, or free market rate, if you will, of the Bolivar is. Because the government says if you give the government $1, they will give you 10 Bolivars. If you give a dollar to a man on the street, they will give you 31,000 Bolivars. That is, and that is room for corruption too, because those generals who are billing the government get to buy those chickens at 10 Bolivars to the dollar and then resell them or resell the dollars, can turn around and resell those dollars for 31,000. So your profit is basically, is immense. It's a money-making machine. The government tried to stop that by making it illegal to publicize or talk about the black market rate, hence Voldemort, the character in the evil villain in Harry Potter, whose name must not be mentioned.
Thank you, Russ, for this contribution to economics lexicons, as well as our understanding of what's happening in this this devastated country. We appreciate your reports from time to time. Look forward to talking with you again soon. Next up, we'll talk a little bit about that and also the Middle East with Dr. Luis Fleischman. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Dr. Luis Fleischman. He is a senior advisor to the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project at the Center for Security Policy, where he edits its important online publication, The Americas Report. Luis is also an adjunct professor of political science and sociology at Wilkes Honor College at Florida Atlantic University. He is the author, most recently, of Latin America in the Post-Chavez Age, The Security Threat to the United States. Luis, welcome back. It's good to have you, sir.
The same here. Like always, it's a pleasure to be here with you, Frank.
Thank you. I wanted first, before turning to another subject matter area of expertise of yours, the Middle East, Luis, just to get your read on what we were discussing a moment ago with Russ Dallin, and that is the elections over the weekend in Venezuela, in which the government seems to have secured a rather remarkable success in many of the gubernatorial contests. What did you make of that, Luis, and what is it likely to do for the people of Venezuela, or to them?
What I make of it is that it's clearly an act of fraud, that the gubernatorial elections were used by Maduro to send a message to the international community that the Maduro government is legitimate and they should stop the pressure. But I think, hopefully, and this depends a lot on the international community, and particularly our administration, is that that should backfire. When I mean backfire, that means it's clear an act of fraud. And I am going back to the repertoire of the Ukrainian elections back in 2004, when the clarity of the fraud, basically, led the international community to isolate then the president of the Ukraine, if you recall, and actually caused the so-called Orange Revolution. So I think the same needs to happen now. This is clearly an act of fraud. There have been a number of irregularities, and the result is extremely suspicious, given the fact that most recently we experienced a major uprising in Venezuela, discontent, and tremendous repression on the part of the government. This result is not logical by any means. So this is now where I urge the Trump administration to impose full sanctions along with the Europeans, along with the Organization of American States. This is the time to isolate and to force the regime of Nicolas Maduro out.
Luis, you've just done an interesting piece for us at the Center for Security Policy about the recent enactment by the House of Representatives, unanimously no less, of legislation called the Nicaraguan Investment Conditionality Act. Talk a little bit about it and why it is so important and whether perhaps it is an indication of what might be done in Venezuela as well.
I think it is extremely important because it puts pressure on the Nicaraguan government to stop committing acts of fraud. That's what Ortega, the President Daniel Ortega, has been doing for a long, long time. This is what he was probably about to do on the upcoming elections on November 5th. For the first time, we are seeing the Congress enacting a law aimed at basically forcing the Nicaraguan government to respect democracy. And why is this possible? It's possible, first of all, because the Obama administration is no longer there. And obviously, this is easier. Remember, the Obama administration tried not to upset the Latin American countries. He viewed the situation as such that the United States is perceived in Latin America as a perpetrator, let's say, and therefore it cannot enact anything, even not to promote democracy in those countries. And now the Congress unanimously approved the NICA Act, which is aimed at imposing sanctions on Nicaragua unless he straightens up and imposes the rule of law and ceases to commit fraud in elections.
Yeah, that's a heavy lift and highly unlikely, it would seem, given Ortega's background. But I think it does indicate a degree of unanimity on the part of at least the House of Representatives that is impressive. Let me switch gears if I can. You've also spent a lot of time over the years studying and thinking and writing about the Middle East. And I wanted to get your take on the attack on the Kurdish areas of northern Iraq by forces that are, let's be honest, essentially proxies of or simply the agents of the government of Iran. What is your sense of the implications of this attack and where it is likely to impinge upon our interests?
Well, I think this attack is not to be tolerated by us, regardless of what kind of relation we have with the Iraqi government. First of all, this relation is not particularly strong because the federal government in Iraq, immediately, as soon as the Kurds expressed their desire to have the referendum, they immediately went to the Iranians in order to block the Kurds. The Kurds have been our allies because they fought ISIS, and they obviously intimidate the government of Iran. Therefore, the government of Iran is very afraid of a Kurdish independence. Therefore, it is in our interest to defend the Kurdish interest at this point. And in my opinion, every alliance with the government of Iraq, regardless of how important that would look, is not as important as an alliance with the Kurds, because they are our real allies. We cannot betray our allies. The attack of the federal Iraqi government on the Kurds is a crime that we need to oppose vociferously.
Well, we will see if the Trump administration sees it that way and takes the necessary steps. I agree with you that an independent Kurdistan, not only with respect to the problem posed by Iran, but also, for that matter, Syria and Turkey, is a good thing for us. Let me ask you about one other thing. As Iran moves into this so-called Shiite crescent that it's forging from basically Yemen all the way up through to the Mediterranean, it is coming increasingly close with its own forces and those of Hezbollah and other surrogates, the Syrian government among them, to red lines that the Israelis have drawn. And not to be confused with the red lines that Barack Obama once drew, what do you think the implications of that might be, Louis Fleischman? Are we looking at the prospect of an imminent and potentially quite bloody conflict between the Iranians and the Israelis?
Well, yes. I believe that the Iranians are probably going to try to avoid a direct military confrontation with Israel because they understand that they are not, at this point, they don't have that capability military to confront the Israelis. I do not know whether it's going to reach that point. It seems to me that the Iranians are going to act more rationally than, let's say, somebody like Saddam Hussein would have. But on the other hand, and you touch upon a very, very important point, is the whole question of revisiting the Iran nuclear deal. Because one of the most important, I would say, defects that the Iran nuclear deal had, among others, of course, was the fact that it was not a package aimed at containing Iran altogether. In other words, it didn't include the non-nuclear activities of Iran, which is subversion, which is their involvement in different countries such as Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, and many others, where they are trying to influence the different regimes, they are creating proxies, they are creating subversion and violence. In other words, what the government of Barack Obama did was basically saying to the Iranians, if you agree to reach a nuclear deal, we will give you a green light to expand your power in the Middle East.
Yeah. This is so important against the backdrop of what President Trump did last week with respect to this Iranian deal, Louise Fleischman. We will come back to you to discuss this at greater length. We are hard out of time at the moment, though. We have to say goodbye. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.